Hi there, and welcome back to the Hugo's There podcast. I'm your host, Seth Heasley, and I'm reading the Hugo winners one guest at a time. My guest for this episode is Jason Duman, and we are going to be discussing The Yiddish Policeman's Union by Michael Chabon, winner of the 2008 Hugo Award for Best Novel. So Jason, thanks for doing this.
You bet. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. You had reached out to me, I think, on the contact form. Maybe it was on Twitter.
It was on Twitter. You posted a thing saying, looking for some readers, and I said, I'll do it.
So, nice. Yeah. Yes, I love that. And you're another Northwest guy?
Yep, up in the Seattle area.
Cool. Well, why don't you tell me a bit about yourself?
Well, I am a lifelong nerd. I started reading, really loving sci-fi and fantasy with Chronicles of Narnia and Lord of the Rings. My parents paid me $5 a book one summer, and I read all of them in that summer. So then turned around and bought comic books with it. And it was a pretty good deal for me. So, since then, I just loved reading. And when I was in my master's program, I started putting together lists because I like projects and just like collecting a bunch of like books that would be someday fun reading. And that's when I discovered the Hugos. I'd never heard of them. And so I put together my list and I started just going to used bookstores and finding stuff. And so that's a little bit about how I got started with all this stuff.
Cool. So you've been tracking your Hugo reading for a while?
Yeah. So I've really since 2015 is when I got going with it.
Nice. And what's your progress on the list?
I am at 23 and a half. So
nice.
I had to walk away from one of them because it was not gripping me at all.
Yeah, that does happen sometimes. I had a previous guest on who had that experience with Dune. So,
oh, really?
Wow. Yeah, it takes all kinds.
Yeah, well, I started reading Dune, but then I got the audiobook, and it was way better.
Mm.
So
the audiobook is excellent for Dune.
Yeah,
yeah.
So
my number, I'm actually up to 35 now. So you know, I'm almost three times the number where I started because I started at 12.
Yeah,
so that's cool. And kind of about you, you're a pastor.
I am. Yes. Up in Linwood, Washington. And so I've been on staff at this church for 14 years, started as the youth pastor. And now you stay in one job long enough, they give you all kinds of different jobs. And I am now, I'm now the lead pastor for the last 4 years. And I'm currently on sabbatical, which has been great. So very needed after 14 years. So married, two kids, I'm raising two nerds.
Excellent.
And, trying to keep it going. So
yeah, that's good parenting.
You know, I do what I can.
Yes. Well, why did you choose this book?
Well, I had never read anything by, is it Chabon? Michael
Chabon.
Yeah, Chabon. I've never read anything by him. But I saw the movie, The Wonder Boys, which is another one of his books. And
oh, I don't think I even knew that that was connected.
Yeah. And so I, saw he was on the list. And I was, I want to read something that is different. But then I was also getting ready to go on a cruise to Alaska.
Oh, nice.
And so I was like, oh, this will be fun to kind of read. And, after reading, going to Alaska and seeing like how it's always raining, along the coast and like kind of set the tone for the book a little bit. So,
yes.
And I also was trying to figure out like, why is this on the list? Like, because from Wonder Boys to this, like, doesn't seem like a typical science fiction writer. And so, and this is not a typical science fiction book, I would think, other than, the setting is, but.
Right. It's alternate history. And so that's where it kind of falls into the science fiction category. But I don't think Chabon really set out to write a science fiction book. He just kind of realized it at some point. Well, I guess this is under that general umbrella.
Right.
Did you look into any of the history of the book?
Not really. I was reviewing a little bit last night. And so it started as like a article he wrote was the inspiration.
Yeah. He wrote like an essay sort of lamenting the, or kind of wondering, you know, what it would have been like if there had been like a nation that spoke Yiddish, and kind of lamenting the downfall of the Yiddish language, you know, its disappearance. But he got a bunch of backlash for that because people are like, hey, it's not gone. You know, it still does exist. And so then he's like, well, fine. All right. I'm going to write a whole book about it and really anger people. but yeah, it's, it's fascinating here because, well, I guess we could kind of move into our non-spoiler discussion of the book.
Okay.
So do you want to give kind of the quick non-spoiler synopsis?
Yeah. So a detective, Meyer Landsman, is kind of like washed up. You meet him, he's got a drinking problem and he lives in a hotel. Mm-hmm. And he gets a call that there is a dead body in another hotel, another room in the hotel. So the start is kind of like noir feeling, like trying to figure out like, where's this body from? Who is this? But then at the same time, the Sitka district is on a timeline to go back into U.S. control. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of tension in the police department on like whether or not they're going to have jobs and how to like just ride it out and get to this next chapter of Sitka. Mm-hmm. And And so investigating it gets more and more intense. I don't know where spoilers start.
Right. No, I think just kind of setting up the premise that it's a murder mystery, but it's also set in this backdrop of the alternate history where the proposal to provide land for people who were refugees from Europe, particularly Jewish refugees
right.
in the lead up to World War II, that it actually went through. And so Sitka, instead of being this, like it is today, you know, a town of 9,000 people.
Right.
Is like a district with, I think it's got some, I think it says somewhere in there, it's like 2 million people, mostly Jews.
Yeah. The edition that I have has a little map. And so it says 4 million people in the federal district of Sitka.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think what a lot of people don't realize is that, you know, that proposal to provide that area was in the 30s and 40s. And
right.
this is, you know, more than 10 years before statehood for Alaska, really, you know, more like 20. And so, you know, it's not, there wasn't an actual state of Alaska at that time. And so providing that, it didn't already belong to the U.S.
Right.
Right. I mean, it belonged, I guess, because it had been a territory, right?
Yeah, but it wasn't recognized.
Right. The interesting thing for me is that one of the most vocal opponents of that proposal, I can't remember what the proposal was called, was the namesake of my high school, Anthony J. Diamond.
Oh.
And he's mentioned in the book where the difference here, the departure is that he dies in a car crash, and so he can't oppose it, and it goes through. And so instead of having 6 million Jews killed in the Holocaust, a lot of them emigrated prior to that and end up in this district in Alaska. And that's just it's a fascinating setup.
Right.
But I did think it was interesting that I went to AJ Diamond High School.
Oh, funny.
So, and there's one of the main roads in Anchorage is called Diamond Boulevard. So I guess at this point we can kind of go into overall thoughts. So what'd you think of this one?
It was definitely different from everything else that I have read in the Hugo's list.
Yeah.
I haven't read a lot of noir either. And so,
right.
so it was kind of, it was refreshing just because it was a little different. You know, when I started, I was just kind of trying to read chronologically year by year. And that's part of why I had to abandon The Wanderer because
right.
I was like, this is too boring and this is too weird. and so this was different. I liked it. I liked, you know, not being a Jewish person, not speaking Yiddish. I liked the way that Chabon talked about the culture and like introduced all these Yiddish terms. And my copy has a little glossary in the back. So I was referring to that quite a bit. Like, what are they talking about? And you know, it's a bigger book, but it paced along pretty quickly.
Right.
And so I thought that was really great.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm going to say I really, really enjoyed this one. And like you, I haven't read a ton of, you know, hard-boiled detective novels or anything like that. I've seen more films
right.
that way.
Yeah.
But so I'm kind of familiar with the style of it. And I really do enjoy a good detective story. And this one I feel like has a good plot that kind of spools out slowly,
mm-hmm.
Where there's some twists and turns and you're like, oh, okay, I think I know what's going on. And then, nope, you're wrong. It's something else. And, you know, the Alaska connection for me was great as well. Although I've never been to Sitka.
Yeah, I thought my cruise was going to go to Sitka.
Most of them don't.
Yeah. And so I was kind of disappointed when I looked at the itinerary. I was like, oh, I'm not even going to this town.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, that's a bummer. But I mean, you kind of get the general idea of what the area is like, and it's in a lot of ways it's similar to the Northwest, and more than typical Alaska weather,
right?
Especially with the rain,
yeah.
Because I guess it's people don't generally realize actually how close the Alaska Panhandle is to the rest of the United States, where the mainland of Alaska is quite a bit further up.
Yeah, and having lived in the Seattle area most of my life, like I'm used to rain, but
yeah,
I was surprised by how much rain when I was there. Like, it's raining every day.
Yeah.
So, but that rain, like the, you know, seasonal affective disorder, like it's a real thing.
Oh yeah.
And it really affects the people in our region. And I feel like the book even has a depression throughout it beyond like alcoholism, but like everybody's just kind of like, this is how it is. Like it's,
right.
The book feels damp.
Yeah. I mean, it's that I like that description of it, that it feels damp, because there's the metaphorical dampness, right, of the fact that the district is about to revert back to the US. And yeah, everybody's just kind of, they are either like, I'm going to prepare for this, I'm going to be ready for this, I'm going to get my name on the list for getting to stay here, or they're just kind of fatalistic and like, well, this is yet another setback, but we'll persevere. Yeah. I love the way the characters were drawn. I mean, the book is entirely from Meyer Landsman's point of view.
Yeah.
But I love his partner, Berko Shemets, mm-hmm. I think was his name, where he's half Tlingit, which I thought was fascinating. And then, you know, his ex-wife ends up his boss, Bina Gelbfish.
Right.
I love all the names of them. One of my favorite side characters was Willie Dick, the very tiny Tlingit police chief.
Right.
But yeah, I love the way the characters were drawn. I really, really enjoyed the prose. I thought it was really, really well written. And if anything, Chabon goes overboard on his descriptions sometimes. Although I loved it. I thought it's so vivid, some of his descriptions, where he really knows his way around a metaphor.
Right. Yeah. It definitely made me more interested in reading other books by him. And so I do have on my shelf to read the Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay, which I think will be, you know, more in line with the sci-fi premise of superheroes and stuff. His metaphors are good. His characters are great. The relationships between Berko and Meyer are great. Even Bina, who, like, you meet Bina and you feel like, well, she's the bad guy, like right away. Right. Like
she's
the boss, right? And she's going to try to like stop them from their investigation and all this. But as he unspools their relationship, it becomes a lot more powerful, the tension between them. And and so, yeah, it was great.
Yeah. So in terms of kind of recommending this novel to somebody who hasn't read it and maybe hasn't considered it, you know, like if they're fans of what genres or other properties, how would you recommend it?
Well, I would, if they are in like a detective novel reader, I would recommend it for that.
Mm-hmm.
I would not say go in and say like, oh yeah, this was a Hugo Award winner and it's from a science fiction award, because most of the tropes of science fiction just aren't here, other than alternate history.
Right. Yes.
So yeah, I would definitely, for noir detective mysteries, I would recommend it for those.
Yeah, yeah, and I guess I'd say, you know, if you're fans of something like The Man in the High Castle, where you like alternate history, you just like things told, you know, a story told, but with a slightly different starting premise than our world. But mostly, yeah, I agree. If you want something different in your science fiction reading, where you don't want it to have those, all the trappings of science fiction, then this would be a good way to go. Well, what say we go ahead and get into spoilers?
All right.
Okay. So from here on, you know, I've got a few things written down, but like anything that you want to talk about, let's hit it.
Well, as, you know, starting to read, like I had no idea about the, you know, like once in a generation possibility of a messiah figure. Like if that's an actual part of Jewish culture or what. And so to find out as you read that the dead body, this drug addicted person, was believed to be a possible messiah. Like as I was reading, like, what? How?
Yeah.
Where?
Sure.
But then also, like, as a Christian, and like, have you seen Life of Brian?
I've seen parts of it. I've never seen the whole thing.
Okay. It's a great movie. Mm-hmm. It's just right on the border of blasphemy.
Oh, yeah, I know.
And so, like, it felt like Brian in Life of Brian doesn't know, like, why everybody wants to follow him, you know, right. And he actually tries to resist it quite a bit. And so with the, I'm blanking on the guy's name.
Mendel.
Mendel, yeah. With Mendel, like, not wanting to be a messiah, you know, not running away from his arranged marriage, like trying to distance himself from everything. Mm-hmm. You know, like that, while The Life of Brian is a comedy, like that pressure that people put on you in like a situation where they have such high expectations, it would crush people, you know? So you come to understand, like, yes, this guy was, he was gay. He was addicted to heroin and he was on the run and trying to avoid his life. But it's like, yeah, if you're going to be, everybody's expecting you to fulfill all this, that would be so hard.
Yeah.
So I thought Chabon did a great job with that aspect of it and painting a character that we never actually talk to, never read in any way. Like the dead body, like is as much a character as Landsman. And but then also like the relationship with his sister, who we also never meet because she died in the plane crash, you know, like, but the connection between Mendel and Meyer's sister, like all of these things, like the way the mystery unfolds is so good. It's like,
I was genuinely surprised when her death ended up getting tied into the larger story. Cause I just thought, oh, well, you know, she's a pilot and something went wrong and you know, that kind of thing happens.
Right. But then to figure out that it's all of it is a Zionist conspiracy to establish a national Israel and to destroy the temple of the rock and all of these things.
Right.
And all of that's happening in the bigger universe, but for Meyer and Berko, it's all just trying to figure out who is this dead body and why is he dead?
Yes.
So,
yeah. There's also the connection of chess, which is throughout the whole book, where Meyer's father was this great chess player. And I'm not really much of a chess player. I can play a game, you know, with somebody who's a complete noob and still probably lose. just because I get a little bit in my own head about it. I'm like, okay, there's some strategy here. And then I make a bad move and lose. But that was another thing where it was a thread throughout the entire book. And it wasn't until really, really close to the end where Meyer finally has this moment of clarity and says, oh, I think I know what that chessboard that Mendel had set up means. And the whole idea of having moves available to you, but really no moves available, right? Because any move you make is you lose.
Right.
And yeah, that was very poignant. Yeah. You know, you do really feel bad for Mendel and the position that he was in.
Yeah. Yeah. I like a lot of the chess stuff was kind of lost on me because I don't know the strategy. Mm-hmm. And that was one thing that I felt like at the end of the book, it felt like Chabon was like, I'm done writing now. And so I'm just going to wrap it up real fast.
Yep.
Like even explaining the chess board and all that stuff, it felt like it was just like an avalanche of stuff happening all at once.
Right.
And I read it I finished at the beginning of June. And so it's like one of those things where it's like, I had to go back and read a summary yesterday. Yeah, okay, what was all of this again?
I feel like that avalanche you're talking about is consistent with what I've seen in noir movies where there's little breadcrumbs all along. And then at the end you have the big reveal.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. I've definitely heard of from, you know, kind of Christian Zionist circles, the idea that, hey, we need to blow up the Dome of the Rock, you know, and rebuild the temple and find the red heifer.
Right.
And so like, as soon as I saw the cattle in there, I thought, okay, I know where this is going. Just because in kind of popular culture.
Yeah. I grew up in a church that was very into end times predictions.
Right. Me too.
And our Sunday night services, we had people come with like their charts and graphs of like, when the end times was going to be and like how the beasts in Revelation are like Russia and the USSR and all this stuff. Mm-hmm. And so I actually grew up like terrified
Me too.
Of all of this end times stuff. And so the red heifer, as soon as I with you, like that red heifer shows up, I'm like, oh, this is an end times book. I don't know how I feel about this. Like, I read Left Behind. Please don't do this to me.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I grew up under a lot of fear under that teaching. So
yeah,
like every time I was at home and my parents were a little late, or my family was a little late getting home from something, I'm like, dang it, I missed the rapture again.
Yeah. That's it's a really weird way to grow up.
It is.
And like listening to like, are you familiar with DC Talk? Mm-hmm. So when they covered, Larry Norman's, I Wish We'd All Been Ready.
Right.
You know, and that was one of those things where it's like they're painting this picture of the rapture in this song. And like, yeah, you know what? That is a scary thing to sing about. Mm-hmm. But the melody of the song is so peaceful and calming. But at the same time, it's like, how do we really feel? Like, what should we do with this information?
Yep.
So with your, I don't know, your audience, really, do you have a lot of people who might be familiar with like Christian end times eschatology kind of stuff? Like, would
that's a good question. I don't know. I mean, I know that a lot of it has kind of seeped into pop culture because of the Left Behind books.
Right. So I just kind of wonder if people are reading through this, like if they would also be catching those things, like the red heifer and the Zionism and all of that stuff and Shebon is Jewish, you know, so he's coming from a non-Christian perspective on eschatology.
Yeah.
So it's just it's a different way to look at the expectations and this prophetic reading.
Right.
So,
yeah, I thought it was interesting and I feel like it's kind of true to life too, that if something like this were to happen, if some conspiracy like this were to happen, there's a lot of people in the evangelical church, at least there used to be, who would be all in favor of this. Right. And would be sending money to support, you know, the development of the red heifer and moving people back into Israel.
Yeah. And that's in the book too, is the expect, like there are Christians in America who are trying to support this whole thing. And I my pastor growing up, I know would have been all over it if this was an opportunity. Yeah. It's like, yeah, we're going to establish the national Israel with a temple. Like, we need to do all these things. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so it's one of those things where you're just like, I don't know if that's the right expectation that we should have. And my denomination, you know, we have like 16 fundamental truths. Mm-hmm. Four of them are about the end times. Mm. It's like, these are fundamental truths, but they haven't happened yet.
Right.
So it's one of those things where it's like, yeah, you know, you read the Bible and you say, oh, this could be how this all pans out. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, it's like, we're going to hold that so tightly that it's our like core doctrines. It's like, should it be?
Yeah. So yeah. Careful.
Yeah, I know. This is going to go on the internet. And so I should probably just stop questioning my authorities.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know though. I feel like that's healthy.
Well, it's part of the conversation to have. And
yeah,
otherwise you get into this whole, like you get into the fear, but you also get into a lot of control. Mm-hmm. Around, if you're not willing to have the conversation.
Yes.
You know, and so even to get back to the Yiddish Policeman's Union by Michael Chabon, the guy who does the maps for the town,
right,
who like runs the string all over town to make sure like the string is a wall and you're in the wall, you're in home, like all of these like workarounds around Sabbath laws and that kind of stuff.
Right.
You know, that's, you know, can be easily construed as like a system of control to accomplish what you want, instead of like letting like the doctrine and scripture prove to be mysterious and informative. You know, you're just trying to make sure like, well, we don't want to break the rules. Right. So we got to, you know, and I'm generalizing, I know, but it gets really easy just to get focused on details and lose the story.
Yes.
For the Hebrew scriptures and the Christian scripture, like if you lose the story and just get focused on all the details, you lose the point of why you read the story in the first place, you know? And so there was a lot of stuff that this book stirred up in me as a pastor and a Christian reading a Jewish perspective. It was a different book and it was really, really good.
I thought it was interesting that, you know, it does mention kind of the different strains of Judaism, where you have the verb over I think they're like the Hasidics, right? The Hasidim.
Yeah.
Where the black hats, they call them.
Right.
Right. Where they have the big kind of wool hats and stuff.
Yeah.
Where other people, you know, just have a little yarmulke. Mm-hmm. And we were actually in Israel last September, and it was interesting to see the different kinds of ways that people dressed or the different kind of yarmulke or the side locks. And, you know, some people had like a shaved head, but still had the side locks, which was fascinating.
Interesting.
Yeah.
That is one thing about evangelical Christianity that, you know, as the way you dress in so many world religions communicates to the world,
right,
your belief. Mm-hmm. And as a evangelical pastor, like, even like looking at mainline denominations or like the Catholic Church, like the fact that the pastor or the priest wears a collar, this communicates right to the world. Like, I'm available for spiritual guidance, or, you know, I'm here to, mm-hmm. I'm, you know, but so much of evangelical culture is like, we're kind of just mixed in, we're blending in, we're kind of hiding. Mm-hmm. Whereas, like, you look
especially in the Northwest, right? We're wearing football jerseys and shorts to church,
right? Yeah, and so like the when you read about the black hats and all this stuff, it's like, you know exactly what's going on with that person, and like you know, like their fundamental beliefs. You know, they take their faith seriously, mm-hmm. and that that's one of the things. Like, you go to Israel and you see all this variety of Judaism in Israel. Mm-hmm. That like people in the States, like, we have no idea how much and how specific all of those different garments and hairstyles and all that, like, what all that means, because our, mm-hmm. our evangelical culture is just like, well, just if you wear a button up and jeans, you're pretty dressed up.
Right.
You know? So,
yep. It was interesting kind of talking, going back to, the guy with the ropes, right. And the maps.
Yeah.
The idea of, I've always heard that called building a fence around the law, where like the law is that you shall not work on the Sabbath, right? So, well, what does work mean, mm-hmm. right? How far can you walk without it being work? And that's where that comes in, right?
Right.
As long as you haven't left your home, you're not actually, you haven't left anywhere. Therefore, the whatever distance the walk is doesn't count. Mm-hmm. When we were in Israel, we actually ended up going to the Western Wall in Jerusalem on the Sabbath. And so there was a sign up that said that the metal detector where you had to put your backpack through was set to Sabbath levels. So there must be some low level of detection they can do that does not constitute kindling a fire on the Sabbath, which I thought was fascinating.
That is interesting. Mm-hmm. Huh?
Yeah. I want to talk a little bit more about the characters.
Okay.
I was a big fan of Bina, because like you said, at the beginning, I thought, oh, she's just going to be the ball buster, you know, who comes in here and she makes Meyer's life a living hell, but she does her very best to support him and, you know, not just take his badge away from him
right
at the drop of a hat.
Yeah.
And he really goes through the ringer, right? He gets knocked out at least twice.
Yeah. He wakes up naked, in the camp, on the island. Bina is interesting because, like, the way Meyer talks about her, like, she hates me. And it's not until almost the end of the book where you realize the tension is, mm-hmm. Because she had an abortion and like he felt like he made her do that.
Right.
And so he's carrying this guilt. And like as a, you know, somebody who didn't have a great relationship with his dad and maybe he thought like, I don't know if I can be a dad. I don't know if I can do this. I don't like whatever reasons led to like their decision. Like he's carrying that guilt in a way. That like basically, if I'm reading right, like that broke their relationship.
Well, yeah, he felt like he let her down.
Right? Yeah, yeah, but yeah. And she says later, like that wasn't your decision. Yeah,
you don't control me,
right?
Yeah, I thought that was really powerful when she said, you know, the only time you'll have that much control over me is when you're like sprinkling my ashes,
right? Yeah. So, but yeah. I thought she was really her character development was surprising for sure.
Yes,
and
yeah, because they end up I can't remember the name of the guy who kind of comes in and says at the end, yeah, no, you're not going to actually follow this up. You're not going to expose any of this kind of stuff. You're just going to shut it down. The U.S. attorney is going to call you and tell you to leave it alone. And then she gets off the phone with the U.S. attorney and says, I was this close to having everything, you know, ready for the transition. And when she started saying that, I'm like, okay, this is where she's about to go rogue, which is true, essentially, where she's like, you know what? It has not reverted yet. I still have my own authority. I can investigate who I want to investigate. I'm doing this. Let's go, Landsman. And I like the way she says, like, come on, Yid.
Yeah. Yeah. I thought the tension with Burko and just trying to, you know, he's got a family and he just wants to make sure that he's going to have a job when this whole thing's over. But his willingness to go along with Landsman for so much, knowing like this is really risky for him. So that whole dynamic with Landsman and Burko, and Burko even at some point is going like, I can't go this way with you. You know, like it's not like the buddy cop where it's like wherever we go, ride or die, we're in this. But he had a limit.
Yeah. Well, I liked at some point he was kind of moving towards that ride or die thing after his dad had tried to shoot himself.
Yeah.
And then ends up on the phone with his wife, and his wife's like, you know, you're going to stay at the hospital with your dad. And I like that. I thought that was a strong wife move.
Right.
Like, no, there's a greater duty here, that your duty is to your father. Mm-hmm. So that was cool. Anything else you've got written down that you want to talk about?
You know, I do like how it ends with just, you know, calling up the reporter, just saying like,
right.
I've got a story. But
right.
And so it makes you, as when you finish it, to feel like, oh wait, is this so Landsman is the protagonist, but the person who actually told us the story could be this reporter, Brennan.
Sure.
You know, and so I thought that was fun. And it felt a lot, you know, going back to the noir thing, like kind of like Hollywood Boulevard. Have you seen Hollywood Boulevard? It's old. It won Best Picture in the
No, I don't think I've seen that one.
But it starts with a dead body in a pool.
Okay.
And so it's told from the perspective of the dead body in the pool. Like, it's his story. Like, So how did you get here?
Sure.
And so I've got a story for you, like, felt like kind of like that same move, like, but I didn't know, like, it was going to be a have I got a story for you kind of thing with the whole time. So, yeah. But that made me kind of want to go like, oh, now I should read it again, knowing the story and knowing like that it's, you know, it's as told to Brennan.
Yeah.
You know?
So. Yeah. This is one that I definitely want to go back and reread, just because once you find out, you know, who actually, because ultimately it comes back to, well, who committed this murder? And when that reveal happens, and I don't want to give away that part, but like, I want to go back and look for breadcrumbs on that one. Because I think they're there.
Yeah.
But yeah, this one will definitely reward a reread.
Yeah, I would hope so. Yeah. I paid $2 from Half Price Books for it, and I feel like I got my money's worth for sure.
Yeah, I got this one from Barnes & Noble from my Nook a number of years ago, and it was only a couple bucks. And I'm like, this, definitely worth it.
Yeah.
And I'd like to look at some of his other stuff, just because the way he crafts a sentence, I want to read, actually, kind of just getting an idea of his powers of description and metaphor. Mm-hmm. So here we go. It's a pretty long quote, actually. Rabbi Heskel Spillman is a deformed mountain, a giant ruined dessert, a cartoon house with the windows shut and the sink left running. A little kid lumped him together, a mob of kids, blind orphans who never laid eyes on a man. They clumped the dough of his arms and legs to the dough of his body, then jammed his head down on top. A millionaire could cover a Rolls Royce with the fine black silk and velvet expanse of the Rebbe's frock coat and trousers. It would require the brain strength of the 18 greatest sages in history to reason through the arguments against and in favor of classifying the Rebbe's massive bottom as either a creature of the deep, a man-made structure, or an unavoidable act of God. I just, like, when I read that, I think I was listening to it at that point, because I was kind of doing the thing where I'd read a chapter and then I'd listen to it because I had the audiobook.
Okay.
And I think in that one, I had gotten ahead of myself on the audiobook, and I listened to it and I was like, wait a second, I got to go back. And I went and picked up the book and read along with it. I just thought that was fantastic.
Yeah. All that to say, the rabbi was a fat man, but like, that's how like the sparse, like, Cormac McCarthy description would be, he was fat. That is a rich, rich description. And like, as a detective who, like, you know, needs to observe and recognize, like as a character walking through that, you would think he would be descriptive, you know, for Landsman. And so, like, I wonder if that's everywhere in all of Chabon's books, or if that's specifically for for this protagonist.
Yeah. One other one that I really liked was he sets up Landsman as this, you know, sad sack, who I get the impression he hasn't even filled out the paperwork that he needs to in order to even possibly stay in Sitka.
Right.
And, you know, he's drinking too much. He's not doing a good job as a detective. And at some point he finds this passed out musician in a bar where he is. And the guy's got this bottle of vodka, and it says, "After a brief but vigorous debate, Landsman decides not to throw the bottle in the trash, where it will be of no use to anyone. He transfers it to the snug hip pocket of his own decline," which I just thought was fantastic. And it wouldn't work if you didn't already have the character set up as in decline.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. See, I read through and I didn't like note anything. I have a hard time highlighting fiction because I want to read it and like experience it. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I do think, yeah, his descriptive power is pretty good. Pretty good. Yeah.
Yeah. And this one is, like we said from the beginning, right? This isn't your typical science fiction book.
No.
It's, you know, it's more literature, you know, but it's also like that kind of potboiler novel in some places, where it's the detective story. And so there isn't as much plot stuff to talk about without going into the nitty gritty of exactly how the plot unfolded.
Right.
And I think we do it a disservice to do that, because I'd like people to experience this one. Even though we've gone through some spoilers, we haven't really spoiled any of the major twists and turns other than that, the big one. Right.
Yeah. But you can't really talk about this book without talking about that. So, but yeah, and there's just so much more that happens. So, do you find like with your, because I haven't read all the books that you've done in your podcast already. So I don't listen to those. Do people tell you like, I listen to all of them no matter what, even if I've read the book?
Yeah. I have had a couple of people tell me that they do that and they appreciate the non-spoiler section, but, generally they're just like, you know what? I count on myself to forget everything by the time I read it.
Yeah. So well, that's,
and you know, there've been studies that showed that knowing the spoilers prior to reading a book or seeing a movie in some senses enhanced the enjoyment of them, because then you could actually kind of watch for the signs of it. Like if there's a twist or something, where you know, instinctively we think, I don't want to know the spoilers. I want to enjoy it on its own. But in practicality, lots of times, you know, people still do enjoy it because they enjoy the craft of the storytelling.
Yeah. Well, I think, yeah, that's interesting. Like when I watched The Sixth Sense, I've only watched that movie one time, and partly because it's, you know, there's some gore that I like, I don't really need to be, I don't need more of that. But the Unbreakable by Shyamalan, like, that's one of those movies that has a pretty great twist. And I can watch that over and over again. And I love it every time.
Yeah.
Because I know where it's going, but I also love the way he tells the story. But it's more about the character, you know, than the twist. So yeah.
Yeah. The Prestige is the same way for me. Like that's one it's one of the first Blu-rays that I have that I bought, and I've watched it dozens of times, and I enjoy it every time.
I have not seen that. I have checked it out from the library multiple times, and then I just can't. I can't find time when I check it out to actually watch it.
Yeah.
So I'll have to.
I definitely recommend it. So I won't spoil anything. I think it's fantastic.
Is that Nolan?
It is Nolan.
Yeah.
I will tell you, there's really no good guy in the movie.
Great. Okay.
Just prepare for everybody to be a little awful.
That's fine. I know. I mean, we're talking about movies now, but No Country for Old Men. Have you seen that?
Right.
Like it's the same kind of thing. There's no actual good person. And the best person is ineffective in the whole movie.
Oh, Tommy Jones, the detective?
Yeah. He can't. He's always like three steps behind.
Yes.
And, but it's still one of the best movies I've ever seen.
Yeah. My son and I watched that one a couple weeks ago.
For the first time? Like you watched it. Yeah. You guys just watched it for the first time? Or?
No, I had seen it, but he hadn't seen it yet. And he's like, that was really good.
How old is your son?
17.
Okay.
So he's at a good age for enjoying movies.
My son is 13. And so we just watched Star Trek, the motion picture for the first time on Thursday. And I was like, you need to be ready. This is a really boring movie.
Right.
but the end is like, is super interesting. So he sat through the whole thing and he asked questions and everything. But I was like, telling him like ahead of time, like this movie is not going to be exciting.
Right.
Helped frame it. And so like, even like, you know, talking about the book, like giving people the expectation, like this is not going to have like spaceships and aliens. Like right. that helps. Cause if you read through the Hugo list, you know, and you're expecting, like I just finished Ancillary Justice, you know, and mm-hmm. you are expecting like that kind of book for a science fiction list. Like this is definitely right. not going to be that book. Mm-hmm. And so the framing of it is super important. And so I had no framing when I read it and I enjoyed it. But if somebody just fell into this book looking for like, so when do the aliens show up or where's the magic going to come?
Right.
There's none of that.
Right. Yeah.
So,
yeah, it's definitely good to have that information going in. Although I will say that, I mean, I kind of knew that there wasn't going to be a ton of science fiction tropes in this one. And I found it really, really readable. I just read it in a few days once I actually kind of started reading it in earnest. Mm-hmm. I had read a couple chapters of it and then I went back and started, like I said, listening to the audiobook. And once I caught up with myself, then I kept just plowing through.
Yeah.
And yeah.
Yeah.
Good stuff.
All in all, good book.
Yep. I guess that kind of suffices for final thoughts.
Yeah. It was good.
Well, do you want to give any kind of contact information out if people want to find you on Twitter or any place?
Sure. My Twitter handle is JDEUMAN at, no, that's my, no, just JDEUMAN. I'm not good at internet.
Right.
And so that's kind of where I'm most active. I also have a Facebook page, but I haven't been using that much lately.
Right. I guess I forgot to ask you up front, how did you find the podcast?
I think it was from the Sci-Fi Christian.
Okay. That makes sense.
Or I found Sci-Fi Christian through you. So, cause I was reading, you know, going through the list and I love podcasts in general. And so, I was like, I wonder if anybody is podcasting through the Hugos. So I think that's how I found it. Just looking in the directory and finding somebody was. So yeah. And then. Yeah. So I think it was you, then Sci-Fi Christian, and then, and now we're here.
Awesome.
So,
well, I'm glad you found me, and I'm really glad that you reached out to me because I was looking for participants and guests and,
Well,
this was a fun discussion.
Yeah. It was a good time. And if you need somebody else, then again, in the future, I'd be happy to read another book because I love to read. So
sounds good.
It's not hard.
Cool. Well, thanks again for doing this. It was a lot of fun.
You bet.
Talk to you later.
Bye. All right,
bye. Well, everybody, I hope you enjoyed that discussion with Jason about a really interesting book. I do want to remind you, of course, if you want to reach out to me, you can do that feedback@hugospodcast.com, or you can tweet at me @hugospodcast. And I am trying to put together my roster for late summer and fall right now. So if you're interested in being a guest, or if you know somebody who you think I should consider, do fire off a message to me about that. I also want to let you know you can support me on Patreon if you would like to, patreon.com/hugospodcast. And I've been remiss in thanking my first two supporters, Michael Simshauser and Roger Anderson. Thank you so much, you guys. I really appreciate it. You're awesome. Okay, I think that's going to wrap it up for this time. I'll talk to you next time. Bye.
The theme music for the Hugo's There podcast was composed and performed by Tim Kusky.